Hello, I'm Paul Letters, historian, novelist, and radio broadcaster. Thanks for joining us for This Month in History, brought to you by Noreen Meir and RTHK Radio 3. For more history podcasts, plus my World War II novel, A Chance Kill, please see paulletters.com.
Welcome back to the 1-2-3 show with me, Noreen Meir, this Thursday afternoon. It's that time of the month again, This Month in History, with author and historian Paul Letters. Paul, welcome back on the show. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you, Noreen?
Very good, thank you. It was good to bump into you over the weekend for the Rugby Sevens.
Yeah, I achieved a lifetime ambition. I was featured on the Kiss Cam.
Oh, wow. I had no idea they did the Kiss Cam, because it's a very, it's not the first year. They've been doing it.
I don't think so. It felt familiar anyway, but
yeah.
I saw you there, dressed as Wonder Woman in the South Stand, carrying a jug of beer in each hand. That was you, wasn't it?
I wish it was. Yeah, that was me in a parallel universe. Oh, well, it's good to have you back on the program. So what are we talking about this month then?
Well, with the help of former Hong Konger Bruce Gordon, who will be using his own diary account from the time, we'll take a look at an incident where a British warship and its sailors were shot to pieces in the middle of the Chinese Civil War. And also from the 1950s, we'll examine Hong Kong's case of the Kashmir Princess, which involves international intrigue and a tragic mass murder.
That sounds intriguing. All right, well, without further ado, let's introduce Bruce Gordon. We heard from him last month as well. Bruce, welcome back on the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, hi, Bruce.
Thank you very much, Noreen.
Yeah, Bruce was with us last month speaking about how he inadvertently prevented nuclear war between the Soviet Union and China. And he was brilliant, so I recommend listeners that you catch up on the podcast. It's easy to find with the links and descriptions of each episode at paulletters.com. We're on iTunes. There's photos and links, like I say, on my website, paulletters.com. So, yeah, catch up on March's episode with Bruce. He's a former US fighter pilot, and he grew up in Hong Kong.
And went to KG5 as well.
Yeah, went to KG5 school. So today, with Bruce, we're going to... we're going to ask him a couple of things, actually. We'll start with when you were living in Hong Kong, Bruce, at KG5 school, your experiences as a student, how did that interest you in historical and current events and in a career in the military?
Well, Hong Kong was a wonderful place to grow up and see the world. There were so many cross currents from different parts of the world that met in Hong Kong. We had the Indian Gurkha soldiers with their turbans and beards and fierce Kharis knives. And we had the British soldiers and Americans would come through. And we had British Spitfire fighters taking off from the Kai Tak Airport right near KG-5 school. And I went to KG-5 and I could talk to the people about their experiences during the Japanese invasion, conquest of Hong Kong and occupation. That was very interesting.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. And you kept a diary that you've still got, is that right?
Yes, I did. I was going to say that while I was in Hong Kong, one of the stories they told to me that during the Japanese invasion of Hong Kong, a British bi-wing trainer plane took off to get a look at the invading Japanese forces. It was just a trainer, a two-seat trainer, and was putting along, and a Japanese Zero came up to first to shoot it down, and then probably thought that was too easy a thing to shoot down. So he pulled up on the wing of the bi-wing trainer to look at it before shooting it down. but the British observer in the back seat had a Bren gun in the back seat and shot the Japanese Zero's pilot and killed a Japanese Zero with a bi-wing trainer. I think that was an interesting bit of history.
Wow, so that's a sort of an out-of-date training aircraft up against the fearsome Mitsubishi Zero fighter.
Yes.
And with a surprising outcome. So that was a story that you say that KG-5 students who were here during World War II here in Hong Kong told you about, and because you arrived in Hong Kong just after World War II, and you were living here through the Chinese Civil War.
Yes, and a lot of interesting things happened. You referred to my diary. If I may refer to my diary, there was an incident. They call it the Amethyst Incident. There was actually a movie made about the Amethyst Incident, and I've been looking at it on YouTube and comparing it to Mindouts. If I may, I'm going to read from my diary. Now, this is the diary of a 14-year-old boy living in Hong Kong at the time, and I said on April 22nd, 1949, the news is getting hot. The Chinese communists crossed the Yangtze River and claimed they will capture Nanking in 5 days. It is estimated that they have already 30,000 troops on the south bank of the Yangtze. If Shanghai falls, it is about time for us to leave China, but we may wait until January before we leave. Actually, we left in 2 months. I'll continue with my story here.
Sure.
The British sloop Amethyst sailed up the Yangtze River yesterday and was fired upon by communist guns. It ran aground with 20 dead and 20 wounded. The British destroyer Consort attempted to rescue the Amethyst and was driven back by artillery fire with 10 dead and 15 wounded. The British then set up the 10,000-ton cruiser London and the Black Swan, a destroyer. These ships were driven back. The London had 15 dead and 20 wounded. The Black Swan had no dead and 5 wounded. That makes a grand total of 45 dead and 60 wounded. The London, Consort, and Amethyst, and Black Swan, all seriously damaged. Britain may join the Chinese Civil War if the communists don't say sorry for the damage done. Now, that is the story of a 14-year-old boy. And I compare it to the movie, The Yangtze Incident, and am realizing that at the end of my diary, the Amethyst was still up in the Yangtze River, and the Consort was too. My diary sounds like it's over, and they got out.
Yes. I was going to say, as a 14-year-old, you wrote with a lot of perception. How did you know so much about it? Did you talk to anybody about these incidents? How did you know so much about it?
In Hong Kong, we talked about everything that happened in the world. My father worked for the Eastman Kodak Company there, was an American, and we talked about politics and the international incidents in school. We had very good history teaching at KG-5, and I loved history from the very beginning. And having been at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii during Pearl Harbor, I was actually some distance from Pearl Harbor at the time, but I've been very interested in it throughout my life.
Why did you think it was important to keep a diary?
Well, I was about to leave Hong Kong and go back to America. and I wanted to record what was going on in Hong Kong for my memory, and I'm very glad that I did it.
Yeah.
This is actually the second entry that I ever made in my diary.
Oh, wow.
And so
I could write stories, and of course I've written a book since then.
Yeah, Bruce's book, The Spirit of Attack, it's well worth a read for some exciting Air Force encounters. There's a link to that on my website on paulladders.com, or you can go straight to Amazon. The bit that you read us a few moments ago, the Amethyst incident, also known as the Yangtze incident. So this is during the middle of the Chinese Civil War. The nationalists are on the south side of the Yangtze, right up to the riverbank, and the communists are on the north side. And the British ships move upriver from Shanghai to Nanjing. And do you know why do you think the British ships were there?
Yeah, some of the stories on the internet, which I've been reading to compare with my memories, indicate that it was just going up to relieve the ship consort, which was on duty at Nanking to protect the British embassy. But as I remember, and that story indicates the British were unaware that there was a war going on. As I remember from our discussions, there was a effort to evacuate British civilians from Nanking. They had gathered there and were going to be taken down the Yangtze by ship, and that the consort and the Amethyst were there to escort the British. Well, they weren't British, they were probably passenger ships, river ships, maybe ferries, to carry the civilians down to Shanghai. And instead of just to supply, like the stories say, I believe they were going up there to rescue or to escort the British civilians to safety in Shanghai.
Because this was in the midst of a big offensive by the communists, an offensive that lasted...
Yes.
Yeah, from April through to September 1949, which would ultimately, of course, bring the Chinese Civil War to a conclusion, with the communists winning.
Yes, they went up this river apparently just about the same time that the communists were launching their assault across the river. I noticed in the movie, the Chinese says that the British were interfering with the communist operations on the river, and I believe the communists were probably starting to cross the river already when the consort and Amethyst were involved in trying to rescue the civilians from Nanking. So these things happened at the same time. The communist army is probably exchanging fire with the nationalists on the far side, and there is a battle going on, and in the middle of this come the ships, and as the movie barely mentions, the consort, the Amethyst, was following one of the passenger ships out at night, trying to get out under the communist guns. When the communist guns saw the ships, they fired on the passenger ship and sank the passenger ship with heavy loss of life. But they didn't see the Amethyst, or didn't focus on the Amethyst, and the Amethyst got away.
And that was in the darkness.
The passenger ship took the brunt of the attack at night. But that was in July, long after my comment in my diary.
Yeah, so the crisis started in April, April 20th, 1949, and, as you say, went through to the end of July. I've also read that just a little earlier in April 1949, the communists had announced, made clear that they wanted Western powers, Western military out of China. Of course, this is still the end of the era of Western powers seeing Chinese cities, port cities at least, as sort of open cities, and the French and the British and so on had naval ships up and down the Chinese coast. So it maybe that's part of the picture, sending a message that foreign warships not welcome in China. Of course, this really was in China, because this was upriver, not just out at sea. I've also read that the British sold one or two warships of a similar class to the Amethyst frigate, sold them to the Nationalists. So it did cross my mind whether there could have possibly been a mistake or some doubt as to whether they were actually, at least at first, the communists were firing possibly a nationalist ship. Or even if there was no mistake, the communists may well see Britain as an enemy when Britain is arming the nationalist side. So I'm not sure how accidental it was to, in effect, involve Britain in the Chinese Civil War. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Bruce.
I am a believer of the people on the ground doing what they think is best. And I expect that the communist soldiers involved were not really aware of any agreements with anybody. And they probably saw a ship going up. The story says that on Wikipedia that the first firing was small arms, and someone started shooting, then someone else started shooting. Pretty soon, everybody's shooting. This is the way things go. I don't believe that it was a conscious thing. The British, by the way, didn't really maintain much of a force in China. They say remove all forces. There wasn't very much there. They were trying to get out. The only forces that had been there early, American forces, had been the B-29s to attack China that flew out of some air bases there. But there was no great, Western force there. They had these few ships, and the problem was with these ships that they are designed for high speed, high maneuverability on the open ocean. And you put these little destroyers, they're frigates, smaller than destroyer, in the river where they can't maneuver, and there's sandbars and other wrecks over the years being there. The ships are in a very precarious position. That is not a deliberate attempt to attack anyone. I believe they were there to escort the refugees out of Nanking and ran into the Chinese communist invasion crossing the river. They came through at the wrong time. And yes, the Amethyst was on that sandbar and moved around to different places a little bit for 3 months after my diary entry.
And then it was the end of July when it the Amethyst Royal Naval frigate managed to slip away in the dark alongside, as you said earlier, that passenger ship. And the Amethyst...
I'm amazed...
Go on.
I'm amazed that they got away. That was absolutely amazing that they survived.
Yes. Of course, many...
Also credit...
Sorry, do go on.
Go ahead. Okay, that gives me great respect for the British soldiers. I've always had great respect for the British soldiers to tough it out. When things get bad, they stay and they fought like professionals. And they did get out. Their commanders behaved properly. There was They did not give in to the demands that they admit that they were deliberately interfering with the Chinese communist invasion. First of all, I don't think it's true. I believe that they were going there to get some civilians out of Nanking. And they ran into an invasion, a cross-river invasion, which was bad timing.
I'm sure that's right for that specific incident, although I can see how from the communist Chinese point of view that Britain and America at that time, having armed to an extent the nationalists, would certainly be seen as unfriendly forces. But thank you so much for thank you so much for reading from your diary there and giving us this great insight, and thank you for joining us all the way from Kentucky.
Pedestrians should cross the road only when the green man light signal is on. When the green man signal begins to flash, you will have time to finish crossing at a steady pace if you have already started to cross the road. If you are still at the curb, wait for the next green light. People who disobey the traffic lights when crossing the road are liable to a maximum fine of $2,000. Stay safe. Obey the signals.
Excessive lighting creates environmental concerns. If you operate external lighting for decorative, promotional, or advertising purposes and don't want to cause nuisance, join the Charter on External Lighting to tackle the issues. Switch off the lighting from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. or midnight to 7 a.m. Help reduce light nuisance, reduce energy wastage, and save electricity costs. For details, please visit the Environment Bureau's website.
Music was my first love.
Inspired by music lovers. Uncle Ray Cadira with a superb balance of vocal and instrumental classics from the last six decades, including the obligatory Solid Gold Elvis track. Or two. You'll hear treasures you may have missed.
When I love, I get a feeling like I'm traveling.
Rock and roll, swing, and smooch your way down memory lane with Ray Cadira, 10 till 1, weeknights on Radio 3.
Welcome back to the 123 Show with me, Noreen Mair, this Thursday afternoon. In the studio with us, we have author and historian Paul Letters. That was a very interesting account with Bruce earlier, Paul.
Yeah, it was great to hear from Bruce again after he gave us such interesting stories of his experiences last month. It was great to hear from him.
It's very interesting also to hear his account from his diary as well. 14 years old and to write with such detail and you know, precision as well.
Yeah, and he had a sort of obsession with world events. And the military side of things as well.
And then that sort of developed maybe even to his later career in the military as well.
Yeah, in the US Air Force for 20 years.
Yeah.
Do have a look on paulletters.com if you want to catch up with Bruce's stories from last month. Also, all of our back catalogue of these history segments, you'll see descriptions and links and photos on paulletters.com.
And very rare do we have podcasts for the 123 show, but for this month in history, we are podcasted. So
that's great. Yeah.
Testament to your knowledge as well, Paul.
Thank you, RTHK.
Yeah, no, thank you, Paul. All right. So, in continuing with this month in history, we're going to look at a tragic mass murder case as well.
Yeah. It happens in the same area as what happened so tragically in December 2014 with Flight 8501, the Air Asia flight from Indonesia, which was scheduled to go to Singapore. Which so sadly crashed into the sea in bad weather. That spot where it crashed was in the Java Sea near Borneo, where almost 60 years earlier, in 1955, another aircraft called the Kashmir Princess came down. And there's an intriguing story surrounding that. The cause of the 1955 crash of Air India's Kashmir Princess was deliberate. sabotage in the name of assassination. And the target was a very well-known figure. The story begins in India during the Cold War, when India was not aligned with either the US or the Soviet side. Nehru, India's prime minister, first prime minister, of course, wanted to organise what would be the first big meeting of the non-aligned nations, so the nations who did not take a side in the Cold War. And so in 1955, this meeting was organised for to be held in Bandung in Indonesia. It was called the Asia-Afro Conference because most of the nations, if not all of them, were from those two continents. And one of the big names invited to the conference would be the target of the assassination plot, which would end so tragically in this mass murder. And the target was Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai. Now, Zhao had a close relationship with Nehru, and he asked Nehru for an aircraft to take himself, Zhou Enlai, and his delegation to Indonesia. And Nehru sent Zhao one of the Air India's most modern aircraft at the time, a Lockheed Constellation named the Kashmir Princess. And Zhao would board the aircraft, this was the plan, in Hong Kong, when the Kashmir Princess would stop to refuel. On April 11th, 1955, the Air India flight took off from Hong Kong for its final leg to Jakarta. It was carrying 8 crew, plus 8 Chinese diplomats and 3 European journalists. And around 4 hours later, while the Kashmir Princess was cruising along, the crew heard a muffled explosion. Smoke entered the cabin. A fire erupted on the starboard wing, the right wing, behind one of the engines. And an emergency descent was started. And during the descent, the hydraulic systems failed, the electrical systems failed. The crew sent out distress signals, giving their position. The captain tried to land the plane on the sea, but the failing circuits meant that he couldn't control the aircraft. And the crew handed out life jackets, opened the emergency doors for quick escape, and the plane plunged into the sea. And the accident report would later say the probable cause was sabotage, a bomb exploding and puncturing a fuel tank, and then an uncontrollable fire. 16 of the 19 people on board were killed. The captain was among them, but the three survivors were other members of the crew. So you'll be thinking, what happened to Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai? Because he didn't die in 1955. He had caught wind of a possible assassination attempt, and so he changed his plans at the last minute and flew out 3 days later. Of course, he still let Chinese officials, among others, get on board the Kashmir Princess and get killed. He knew that there was a bomb that was going to be put on board, but he later explained it was a sacrifice that had to be made in pursuance of a larger objective. So who's behind the plot? Well, Communist China's intelligence services had learned that Chinese nationalists, the Kuomintang, who, of course, had only 6 years earlier lost the Chinese Civil War that we were talking about, was talking about 1949 with Bruce earlier, and this is 1955, and obviously the Kuomintang lose and go to Taiwan. And the Communists' intelligence said that they had this plan to assassinate the Chinese premier. And the communists said that a Taiwanese agent planted the bomb on board the Kashmir Princess while it was refueling at Hong Kong airport. The British governor of Hong Kong at the time, Sir Alexander Grantham, he denied any possibility of foul play, as if, you know, that couldn't possibly happen here. But a later investigation revealed that one of the airport cleaning crew was a Taiwanese agent named Chao Tse Ming, and he had secretly planted a bomb on board. He worked at Hong Kong Airport at Kai Tak, and the bomb was triggered. I will ask you who you think made the detonator. It was triggered by a newly developed detonator made in guess which country? Taiwan would go to get its military expertise.
Oh, if I had to venture a guess, I think it would be the US.
You got it. So that, of course, brings in questions, certainly from the Chinese Communist point of view, were the CIA involved? 2 decades later, Zhao Enlai met Henry Kissinger in the 1970s and asked him if the CIA had tried to assassinate him back in 1955. And this was during the thaw in relations between China and the US. And when they're being friendly to each other in the 1970s, it's something we mentioned on a previous show a couple of months ago, where Nixon and Kissinger went to China to meet with Zhao Enlai and Mao. And Kissinger is said to have smiled diplomatically and replied to Zhao Enlai, Mr. Premier, you greatly overestimate the competence of the CIA. That's kind of a typical Kissinger lie, where you're obviously left at the end of it.
He didn't deny or admit it.
Exactly.
It was just sort of very diplomatic.
Yeah, very diplomatic.
But with a slight sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Putting ourselves down
yes,
a little bit.
Exactly. Puts a smile on our face, but I suppose Zhao Enlai, I wonder what he was thinking when he heard that at the time. I don't suppose he was laughing about it.
No, the Chinese are very good at self-deprecation. And that's what the Americans did. Paul, just going back to something you said earlier, and having done a little bit of research on the Kashmir Princess, I'm really surprised that Zhao Enlai, Premier Zhao, actually caught wind of this and knew he'd be a target. It's quite fascinating that he knew in advance, but he still continued along with it, and just before boarding just decided to change his plans.
We don't know for sure exactly how they found out. Of course, they weren't gonna, the Chinese Communist intelligence were not gonna tell the world how they did it, but they had, you know, there was someone who informed. But they certainly got good, from their point of view, well, certainly good intelligence, correct information. And, Zhao Enlai waited 3 days after that. He must have been, wondering whether there was any sophisticated second possible plot. You know, he must have been getting paranoid, in that situation, one would. But he still flew out to Indonesia.
Yeah, but it would also play on one's conscience that you were the cause of that explosion. And would you not try and stop it? I suppose us regular people, normal people would think like that.
Well, yes, of course. But to get to the top, particularly in a totalitarian regime in Mao's China, to get right to the, he's really right-hand man to Mao. I don't think you'd be too, your sensibilities
would be for the lives.
Yeah. Well, so certainly from that quote, he wasn't.
Yeah.
And we've seen before how Mao has willingly risked possible nuclear strikes by provoking the US over Taiwan when he started shelling Taiwanese-held islands off the coast of mainland China. And Russia, Communist Soviet Union, was concerned about this. But Mao was saying, kind of, so what if America attacks? We've got so many hundreds of millions of people. We'll be fine even if we lose 1 or 2 million.
Good point that you make.
It's a different, it's certainly a different way of looking at things to how we would certainly expect our leaders to today. Mm-hmm. Back on that case, the Taiwanese agent managed to escape to Taiwan immediately after the crash. We believe he probably was helped by the CIA. The Hong Kong police apparently tried to extradite the agent Chow. How hard the British regime tried, obviously on the same sort of side, so to speak, as America and Taiwan at the time, I'm not too sure. But
and the fact that it happened in Hong Kong, I mean, God forbid if it was now, it would be sort of a base for subversion. But because it happened before, under still British rule, I suppose there wasn't much that China could have done, really.
Yeah, and of course, China was communist China was so much weaker than it was now.
Their
goal was to catch up Britain, which to think of that as today is obviously so much the other way around. It was a different world then, of course. But anyway, Taiwan refused, of course, to extradite their agent, and they denied he was an agent. In the decades that followed, Chinese specialist Professor Steve Tsang, he investigated British, Taiwanese, American and Hong Kong archives and concluded that the Taiwanese nationalists did have a special operations group in Hong Kong, stationed permanently in Hong Kong, of around 90 agents in the 1950s, responsible for planning possible assassination and sabotage, obviously against the Chinese communists. And in 1955, the group recruited Chow because he worked at the airport and he had access to the Air India plane. And they apparently offered him 600,000 Hong Kong dollars in 1955 and then safe refuge in Taiwan afterwards. The Hong Kong government did round up, the police did arrest 71 other suspected Taiwanese agents shortly after that, but ultimately released all of them, apparently for a lack of evidence. So nobody was ever punished for the blowing up of the Kashmir Princess and obviously the tragic loss of life of all the innocent people on board.
I was just going to add, Paul, this is completely a little bit off the subject, but on the subject of Premier Chiang Kai-shek, if you type in Google search Chiang Kai-shek, a couple of suggested searches will come up, and Chiang Kai-shek handsome is one of them. I just thought it was quite interesting. And if you click on it, there's a link following 8 most handsome Chinese men and Premier Chiang Kai-shek.
I hadn't noticed myself. Yeah. I don't know how you feel.
Well, I mean, he's not bad. I'm not sure. Yeah. Well, I can't say. Well, I can say he's not good looking, but I won't. He's okay.
What do you think?
It's not bad.
Yeah,
he's no George Clooney, but he's not.
I find it hard to judge, but I'll go with your judgment on that, Nuri.
All right.
Well, how about, have you seen pictures of a young Castro, Fidel Castro?
No, I haven't. I suppose on T-shirts.
So, well, he was quite a hit. I'm not saying that he was considered the best-looking guy in the world, but he was certainly quite popular, surprisingly popular, even in America in his very early days. So I wonder if you wanted to know more about Fidel Castro's visit to the United States in...
He visited the United States?
Yeah, soon after he became leader of Cuba. So he overthrew Batista, who was the Cuban leader the Americans had put there. So obviously pro-American, the Americans guy.
He hates the United States.
And the United States hate him. Yeah, but at the time in 1959, at first, Castro denied being a communist. And so he said, no, I'm not a communist. This is not communism or Marxism, but representative democracy and social justice in a well-planned economy. That's how he described Cuba at the time. And he was keen to reach out to the United States in the hope of gaining economic assistance for his new regime in Cuba. And so it was just 4 months after he became leader on the 15th of April, 1959, that Fidel Castro visited the United States. And although the US politicians certainly were, many of them anyway, were wary of him, American journalists loved him with his stories of fighting in guerrilla warfare. And he would just wear every day that combat gear. There's a photo, or there's, in fact, there's a series of photos up on paulletters.com, a sort of scrolling photos of his visit to the US. And with his cigar, of course, sticking out of his mouth and people coming up to him and hugging him and kissing him and so on. And so the American journalists loved him, of course, because it made for good copy, as they say. It made for good stories and sales for American newspapers. So he accepted an invitation from the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and that's who he went to see in America. The trip got off to, I suppose, a not-so-good start when President Eisenhower decided to go off and play golf in order to avoid any possible chance meeting with Castro when he arrived in Washington. So Eisenhower made sure he was out of town and wouldn't be pictured with Castro. In New York, Castro gave a talk to the Council on Foreign Affairs, which was a group of private citizens and former government officials who were still interested in U.S. international relations. So he went around giving one or two talks, and then finally, before departing for Cuba, he met with Vice President Nixon. So we do have, photos of him meeting Nixon. And Nixon would later say Castro was incredibly naive about communism. So that may just be, of course, Nixon trying to cover his own back later on. But bearing in mind, obviously, Nixon's Republican. He's vice president at the time in the 1950s. This is the same decade as McCarthyism. It's still, maybe surprising that the vice president goes to meet Fidel Castro, who to us, of course, is a communist leader of Cuba for the next 40-odd years.
I was just going to say, can I just say, I find it quite fascinating and interesting that Castro actually accepted the invitation by the American Society of Newspaper Editors.
Yeah, well, he wasn't going to get invited by the government, so...
But I'm so surprised that this organisation, a newspaper organisation or a union, if you like, would have so much sort of power. It just goes to show that the media back in the day and newspapers sort of had that clout.
Yeah, I guess they didn't have the sort of visa restrictions that they would soon America would soon have against Cuba and embargoes and so on from the sort of early 60s onwards. So I guess it was a freer world in a sense then.
Yeah, ironic.
And of course, after that April 1959 visit, relations between America and Castro deteriorated very, very quickly. And in less than a year, Eisenhower ordered the CIA to begin arming and training a group of Cuban exiles to attack Cuba, which they then did under President Kennedy. So it was planned under Eisenhower, the Bay of Pigs invasion I'm talking about now, but it was planned under Eisenhower, but took place under Kennedy on April 17th, 1961. So we're coming up for the anniversary of the Bay of Pigs as well. And that attempt to overthrow Premier, as he was at the time, Fidel Castro, failed disastrously from the American anti-Castro point of view. There's about 1,400 anti-Castro exiles who landed on the island's southern coast at the Bay of Pigs, but they were soon overrun by, we think, 20,000 Cuban soldiers. These rebels were trained and guided by the US and physically taken there by the US military. And they expected that they were going to get support from the US military aircraft as well, that there would be air support. Instead, due to a series of mishaps and lack of support from the US, they really had to fend for themselves. And their failed invasion heightened Cold War tensions, of course, between Cuba's ally, the Soviet Union, and the US. And then that's the following year that we get the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is perhaps the closest the world's ever come to World War III. But that's another story.
Yeah, I'm not surprised he dislikes America so much when he's 89 now, Castro. But over the years, he's sort of survived a few assassination attempts by U.S. governments as well.
It's pretty much only very sort of recent presidencies where you can have credibility and not plan to overthrow the Castros. And what I mean is that just about every president did for decades come up with a plan to overthrow Fidel. And so that's quite a relatively recent thing that they seem to have stopped doing, as far as we know, of course. Who knows?
Yeah, and even after Obama's visit, he sort of came out afterwards, days after, criticizing Obama's visit.
Yes, Fidel wasn't happy, was he? Of course, it's one reason why I mentioned it is because earlier this month, April 2016, of course, President Obama was the first US president to visit Cuba in almost 90 years. And as you say, Fidel Castro, yes, still critical of the US line and coming out with some quotations which you could have plucked from 50 years ago.
Yeah. Well, Paul, what a pleasure to have you on again for this month in history. Thank you so much for all your hard work. And for those of you who are interested in Paul and also his work, please go visit his website as well, paulletters.com. And until next month again, Paul.
Thanks, Noe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. For links on today's topics, plus free chapters from my novel, visit paulletters.com, where you'll also find my daily updates for On This Day in World War II, and lots more free content.